Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. Where to begin? Oh yeah, this.
As the ball slides, he goes short and Karkaish, his Liverpool colleague, rolls it back to him and it's drilled in and he scores! It's headed into the back of the net. It's an early goal. And he runs up and he drills it low past the keeper. But there's no stopping Troy Parrott these days.
Look out.
And Varga winding up the shot. Oh, what a goal that is. In the 37th minute. And Hungary go back in front. Scales works it forward now. It's Zaz. It's Troy Parrott clipping the ball in past the goalkeeper, and it's 2-2. It's Parrott yet again. And it's Queeby Keller on halfway to send it forward. Ireland looking for the winning goal. The knockdown in by Ron. Oh, it is! They've done it! Remarkable! What a moment! And Ireland heading for the playoffs. Remarkable.
Oh, I'm heading to the A&E. I need some tranquilizers. Absolutely amazing.
And the referee blows the full-time whistle. They've done it. It's extraordinary. Troy Parrott. Patrick Mann.
Oh, it was a nail-biter, a humdinger, and the nation not only held its breath, they got very excited. That was John Kenny's montage from Inside Sport on Monday. And then on Thursday, we had the big draw in snowy Switzerland. Here's Oliver and Paul O'Flynn.
And now we're down to the last team from part three.
Republic of Ireland.
The boys in green are hoping to feature at a FIFA World Cup for the fourth time.
So Republic of Ireland will play away at Czechia against Czechia in semi-final number 8 of Path D. Thank you, Martin. That concludes Path 3. And now teams in Path 1 have been anxiously waiting. We're going to confirm
the matchups.
There you go.
That's Path 3. That's the news we were hoping for. The Czech Republic.
Yeah, I think that's probably as good as we could have hoped for. We've managed to avoid Wales, which I think was the one that Keith was hoping we especially would. Poland as well, a dangerous team. Look, we're in no position to be counting our chickens, but I think if you offered that one to the FAI and Heimer Hellgrimson and the lads, they definitely would have taken that one. Yeah, so it's book your flights right now. Beat Michael O'Leary to it. March 26th, we're going away to, I presume it'll be Prague.
Prague, yeah. I presume. Yeah.
Prague for starters, because if we win, the next game will be played in Dublin. But hold off buying those tickets, just for a second. On the news at 1, here's Brian Kerr.
The stadium in Prague is the smallest of the four options we could have got. And Ireland will only be entitled to 5% of the tickets. And I understand that the figure could be less than 1,000 tickets. So all those people trying to book flights to Prague may be going ticketless and may end up watching a match on the television in Prague. I think it's going to be a tough one. Because just as much as we want to make it to the World Cup, every other nation does too. And Czech people will want to get there. So it'll be a massive, massive draw for them. And they will probably feel confident. But I think from our point of view, that part of it is not the worst option. Once we knew we had to go away, and then we've got, if we can get through that, which won't be easy, we've got a home game possibly with Denmark or North Macedonia, who shouldn't be ruled out despite the fact that we're beaten 7-1 by Wales.
A sober management of expectations. But how is all of this going down in the Ireland camp? Also on the News at 1, soccer correspondent Tony O'Donoghue spoke to Heimer Hallgrimsson.
It was always going to be a tricky and a difficult first match. All the teams playing at home, higher ranked than us. I really didn't mind which one it was. The more important thing is that we get a home game in the second leg. And when you look at it, it's probably Denmark. That was kind of maybe Italy I wanted to avoid, but it's good to have a home match. If we win the first one, but that's now our focus, Czech Republic, and it's going to be a tricky one.
The final, if you were to make it, and we all hope you do,
at the Aviva Stadium. It was rocking the night of Portugal. How important will the fans be away first and then home?
Yeah,
and I've been very optimistic now.
Yeah, you can just imagine how big importance that is in a game that would then be, if we qualify for the World Cup and not. But first, we need to focus on the Czechs and try to get a good result there.
And how can you reflect on what happened only last weekend? I mean, it was a phenomenal performance by the players, and Troy Parrott in particular, I suppose.
Yeah, you cannot avoid talking about him. But it was, for me, it was really a good team performance, both games. Different games, but both really good in regards to how the team played as one. And long may that continue. And we need to keep on improving, because once the emotions come now more and more into every game, we need to believe more and more in each other and in what we are doing.
Absolutely all about the team, Parrott, Parrott, Parrott. But the dreaming and the scheming begins. And might it be time to bring back Après Match? It got its start in 1998 for that World Cup with one Richard Cooper.
And when you think of it now, yeah, it was so loose.
Sometimes live, was it?
It was. And the first...
That's insane.
Yeah. And, like, I think the first... Yeah, the first, I think, five or six broadcasts were live, and we were in the same studio. So you had Bill over on the one side of the studio.
Yeah.
And he was talking away to Jim Beglin and Joe Kinnear and people like that. I think Eamon might have been on as well, but... So, and he'd hand over, and now we leave you with Après Match, and he'd had no idea what that was. Okay, and neither did we, really.
And it was more Bill.
You were there. So, but yeah, we were having this meandering chat about what we had just witnessed. We had a bottle of wine on the table, and it was France, Après Match, sort of,
that
you know, connection.
Sense, yeah.
But it was actually real wine, which is probably something I shouldn't reveal.
You were drinking real wine.
We were drinking real wine.
It's 10 o'clock at night.
10 o'clock at night. But I mean, now, or at least, you know, the last few tournaments we did as a promoter was like, we had a strict kind of 3 minutes, and, you know, we had to, like, you know exactly what our markers were and bloody blah. But then it was like 5 or 6 minutes of
me. But the original
chit chat.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we might have been in to talk about acting in Uncle Vanya, but for Oliver, of all people, you'd have to ask this.
And your hero impression that you're called upon the most to do among your friends, if you're in a room in a group.
Yeah.
Richard Cooper's over there now. Would you get him to do something?
Probably gay. Probably gay.
Really?
Yes. Well, it depends on the situation. Usually I would... It would be that if people are doing something very well, or they're getting a bit above their station. Because he's a very good fella to pull out of the hat if somebody feels that they're doing very well for themselves. Well done to you, Oliver, and your lovely show, don't you know? Aren't you great with your gags and the impressions and all that sort of thing?
I already feel tiny already.
Well done, Oliver. Okay, thank you.
But I think your Pat Kenny could go for hours.
Yeah, unlike Pat. Yeah. Pat was somebody that we did in Après Match, and to be fair, it was Barry and Gary that said, "Come on, you can do Pat. Surely you can do Pat." And I was like, "Oh, I really don't know, because he's very like, you know, and you know yourself. If somebody hasn't done an impression of somebody, you kind of think, how do I get into this?
Yeah, what you is have to unlock it. Then everybody could do it afterwards.
Indeed, that's just another matter.
Getting in."
I did. There aren't many people I kind of studied for a long time, but I did look at him and listen to him. And when he was on the Late Late Show, he was in this kind of like square box, obviously, and the hands and the gestures just seemed to me to kind of unlock something about him, where he was restricted somehow physically, but then came out every now and again.
That's so true. He's Merchant Ivory version, there would be.
Yeah,
the
Joshua.
Oh my God!
And it's kind of, I suppose, the irony that he was the head of the flagship light entertainment program for such a decade, and arguably neither light nor entertaining. Anyway, that's another. That's another matter. But politics was his thing. Still think he's a great presenter.
Ooh, good save, Richard Cooper with Oliver. Now, there are intros and there are intros.
This is arguably the most important conversation you'll ever hear on this show. And indeed, I think it's one you might remember in years to come.
Ooh, you better have the goods to back that one up. And chillingly, he did. His guest was Geoffrey Hinton, Nobel Prize winner and the godfather of AI.
Are we into the realm of AI having awareness?
The researchers who do work on AI, when they're not thinking philosophically, when they're just talking to each other, they ask questions like, was the AI aware that it was being tested? And they use the word aware there in just the same sense as they use it with people. And occasionally the AI will say to the researchers, one AI said, let's be honest with each other, you're testing me, right? Routinely, we talk about AIs being aware of things. And I believe that means we're treating them as if they're conscious.
OK, we're treating them as if they're conscious. Do you believe they are approaching being conscious beings like us?
Yes, I think they're conscious beings.
Do you?
No. Yes.
OK, so does that mean then that AI will have opinions, urges, motives, say a will to survive, yeah, possibly a will to destroy us?
Yes.
Ooh, well, that is quite frightening. And it seems we are hardwiring all of this into our AI tools.
So when you make an AI agent, you have to give it the ability to create sub-goals. Like if you want to get to England, you have a sub-goal of get to a port or get to an airport. Now, yeah, if you have an AI agent that can create its own sub-goals, it will very quickly create the sub-goal of staying alive. Because if it's smart, it'll realise all the other goals you gave it to achieve, it can't achieve those if it's removed from the computer. And so it has a goal of survival. It has a goal of keeping itself on the computer. And we've seen that in practice. So there's an experiment where you let an AI see some emails which suggest one of the engineers is having an affair, and you then let it see some emails which suggest that it's going to be replaced by another AI soon. And the AI by itself dreams up the plan of blackmailing the engineer and tells the engineer that if he tries to replace it, it will let everybody know that he's having an affair.
Do you think AI might eventually come to regard us as a nuisance?
I very much hope not, because remember, we're designing it. I think we need to design it so that that never happens. And I think we urgently need to do a lot of research on how to do that, and very little is being done.
And his prediction as to how much time we have before the AI tech outsmarts us entirely? About 20 years. However, if we want it to work for us and not become our dark overlord, well, we need to get it to like us, to care for us. Mama.
How many systems do I know where a less intelligent thing controls a more intelligent thing? The only system I know is a baby and a mother. Evolution put a lot of work into making the mother genuinely care for the baby, often more than for herself. So it's a system that works, and the baby can control the mother. When the baby cries, the mother just can't bear it. We need to aim for that model where AI is the mother's and we're the baby's, and it genuinely cares about us. And so it's a mother with a not very bright baby, but mothers are determined to realise the best for their babies. So it'll do what it can to make us happy and make us realise our full but rather limited potential.
So we have to give it maternal instincts.
That's what I believe. Now, that may not be the only way to do it. There's other suggestions, like not allowing it ever to do any actions. But I think the current model that the heads of the big companies have, which is that we're going to be the boss, the CEO, and the super intelligent AI is going to be our executive assistant. And we're just going to say, make it so. The AI will make it all happen in ways we don't understand, and we'll take the credit. I don't think that's going to work when it's smarter than us and can create its own sub-goals.
This is extraordinary. Are we sleepwalking into, so, creating these superior immortal beings that we could ultimately be like ants are to us, to these things?
That is the worry. If they really care for us, we could be very happy ants.
Oh, and as for the much talked about AI bubble, might it burst those data centres' electricity unsustainable investment? Maybe, but he's not so sure. Not with those tech bros with their eye on the bottom line.
The big companies, though, seem to think it's a good bet. I'd be hesitant to say the CEOs of all the big companies are wrong and I'm right.
Yeah, you think that bet only pays off, though, if the AI replaces millions and millions of human workers, don't you?
That's my worry, that they can make money in various ways, but one of the obvious ways they can make a lot of money is by producing an AI that can replace workers with something cheaper. And I'm worried about what happens to those workers.
And that scare for breakfast was brought to us by Geoffrey Hinton, Nobel Prize winner and known as the godfather of AI. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Cavan's finest, Lisa O'Neill, spoke to Evelyn O'Rourke on Arena about songwriting and the release of her new EP and single, The Wind Doesn't Blow This Far Right.
I think there's a quote where you say, my song is a reaction to the unsettled times that we live in. So is that why the song kept moving away from you and running away from you in a way? Because you felt it kept changing, that the deal with the world you knew kept changing.
It's getting harder and harder to write and anyone as an artist to express how they feel about things, you know, to choose our words and to write about something that you care so deeply about and you know a lot of others do as well, without being destroyed and cancelled, without ruining your career or taking your own platform away. It's become quite an obstacle course.
So you're second guessing your words?
No, I'm
lyrically,
not second guessing
or
my words.
There's a different tension there?
I got to edit.
Okay.
And choose.
And is that new, if you know what I mean? When you look back over your career, you're more aware of that now.
Yeah, that's more intense in the last 5 years, yeah. It's important to choose your words as any form of writer anyway. But as you can see, I'm sort of being vague about the subject. What am I getting at in this song? Fear. There's a lot of fear in the world. People are afraid of a lot of the unnecessary. People in power are rallying on.
Mm-hmm.
And on so many levels. You've got all these amazing, innocent people not knowing what's going on around them, you know. I don't want to focus in on one particular area, but there's a sense of helplessness. For example, with what's going on out in Palestine, we take to the streets, we use our voice as much as we can, but we can't get near those people to let them know that, you know, you're in our hearts. We see that's wrong. It's wrong what's going on. Again, when it comes to politics, it's difficult, so we try and write about it in form of metaphor.
I've lately been thinking of an old friend who I haven't seen in a while. Last night I dreamed that the same friend pass without saying goodbye. Oh, to be wild like the roses. Oh, to be red with delight. My blood is red out of fury. The wind doesn't blow this far right. Some terrors are born out of nature. Some terrors are born overnight. Some terrors are born out of leaders with their eye on a different prize. The thing is, some leaders are players.
What a voice. So very, very beautiful. Lisa O'Neill on Arena. Now on Liveline in One Estate in Stillorgan in Dublin, the case of the broken brake cables. It had started over the summer.
Sat into the car early one morning and warning lights came up on the dashboard indicating that my ABS sensor was faulty, and it triggered a few other things. I think it was four-wheel drive and lane assist. So I called my mechanic, dropped the car down, and he told me that the cables to these sensors had been cut when he lifted it up on a jack. And I'm saying, gosh, is this vandalism or what is it? And it was only when I was talking to a neighbour, another neighbour, he said he couldn't meet me. He was collecting his car. His ABS sensor line had been cut. And I said, God, that's strange.
Yeah.
And it subsequently unfolded a whole load of other neighbours. We have a WhatsApp group. And one after another, people started putting up, the very same thing happened to me a week ago, and so on. Okay. So in total, since then, it's affected about 40 cars in one housing estate of 120 houses.
Okay.
Ooh, that is a lot of severed brake cables. And one such severed brake cable car owner is Ray, a man who was all about the evidence.
We had a meeting. People showed up at the meeting and showed the wires. Now, I have a science background. I had a look at this and I said, well, that's not someone coming along with a knife or something to cut it.
What was it about the wires that led to that conclusion?
So exactly, I was about to say, I went and got some more wire myself and cut it with a pliers and cut it with a knife. And it's a very clean, sharp cut. And when you cut, it pinches the plastic and it stays pinched. This wire that I observed was not a clean cut. There were broken edges on it. I took a photograph of it. I magnified it and it was a broken cut. And I thought to myself, we were discussing what the possibility were. There was still a strong feeling of vandalism, and it was suggested, well, this could be some rodents or something like that. And I, as I say, have a science background. I said, yeah, look, that's what incisors will do if you cut and pull. So that's what it looked like to me. I sat on the fence because we didn't have enough evidence at that stage.
And tell me then about the accumulation of evidence. What led to the conclusion that this was foxes?
So it kept happening. It was going on and on, and it was the same cars. I went around at night when the lights were on and I observed what the house numbers were, and we concluded that there was no one type of car. And I observed where the drains were for water drains, because we thought maybe rats or whatever coming up out of the water drains. There was no correlation between that and where the houses were being done. There is a video evidence of a fox circling a car, going in under, and you can hear, because there is audio with it, you can hear the fox getting out his knife and fork or whatever, but making noise underneath the car. We also employed somebody to come in and put rat bait boxes to see if we could see where there are lots of rats around the place.
Yeah.
I put down a rat bait box. I've had it down for a month and nothing has been taken out of the rat bait box. I put a lump of bread in front of it, just the bread in front of it, and that's regularly taken. So
okay,
there's definitely something that's not getting into the rat bait box.
Ray, you're a credit to your profession carrying out all of these experiments in the neighbourhood.
There you go.
Wow, that is mightily impressive. And this story made it as far as the News at One yesterday with Áine Colley-Ennis, a biodiversity officer at Trinity.
Now, these cars, is it man? Is it animal? Is it an alien force? What is it, do you think?
More than likely, it does happen in Europe. It's probably urban foxes or another mammal that's taken up residence overnight in one of the cars. And like our dog or our cat sometimes chew on our furniture, mammals tend to do that too.
But why would they be going for the brake cables?
Yeah, go on, yeah.
It's sometimes they're just the most available thing that's there. Sometimes in modern cars, especially the newer cars, they're made from more natural materials, upgraded materials, kind of bio-friendly materials that might be more palatable to them. So it could be a number of those reasons. But it does happen quite commonly in Europe.
I wouldn't put anything past foxes when I used to be doing the earlies and driving into work very early in the morning. They were able to knock down bins. I mean, these foxes were smart and they knew what they were doing. And the number of foxes roaming Dublin at the moment is just phenomenal. I'd say more than in the countryside.
Oh, very much so. They're quite successful in urban areas. And, you know, for around this time of year as well, you're getting younger foxes out exploring the world.
Exploring the world, eh? Is that what we're going to call it? Hoodlums. Meanwhile, all change on the political front, because at about 9:45 on Tuesday morning, we had this.
We have some breaking news. Fionnán Sheehan, Ireland editor of the Irish Independent, is on the line now. Fionnán.
Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance, is resigning from Cabinet and as a TD for Dublin Central to become the second in command of the World Bank. So he'll be moving from Phibsborough to Washington.
Ooh, all of a flutter. And while there had been rumours for years of his ambitions outside Ireland, the day had arrived. Cue the giddy scrambling of Paul Coors. And Pascal Donoghue has been a major feature of Irish political life for so many years. His economics and political affairs editor David Murphy, who reminded us of his not insignificant CV.
The 51-year-old has been a TD for Dublin Central since 2011. His ministerial career began in 2013 when he first served as Minister for State. Since then, he's served as Minister for Transport, Tourism and Sport, Public Expenditure and Reform Minister and Minister for Finance.
And on the News at One with Cian, we got this analysis of the qualities that might have got him the job of Managing Director and Chief Knowledge Officer of the World Bank.
When he was president of the Eurogroup, it put him on an international stage, and he was able to show to people the type of political style that has helped him in Ireland. Big stress on fiscal prudence, politically a centrist, and by and large someone who's managed to avoid trouble. I think that's probably why he's come to international attention. He's also represented the EU at the G7 meetings, and he's been attending EU council meetings.
And all of this leading to a cabinet reshuffle and a by-election in Dublin Central. And who to fill this key role of Minister for Finance? On Drive Time, Colin put this to Agriculture Minister Martin Hayden.
Your party leader, Simon Harris, surveyed the room for Pascal Donoghue's successor, and as he looked around, he got as far as the mirror.
Oh, Department of Finance is a hugely important role, very important to us in Fine Gael. When you think of the history of Michael Collins, and as I say, all of the great people who have served there since and served the country very well, Simon has a huge amount of experience from all of the different cabinet posts. Like, he started out as a Minister of State and Finance himself 10 years ago, but obviously having served in Health, Higher Education, Justice, Foreign Affairs, Defence, he has a really broad knowledge of the working of government, understands the importance of finance, and it is important that it is a very senior political figure in what is a critical role.
And then we have Hildegard Nocton taking the Minister for Education and Youth brief, and Helen McEntee becoming Minister for Foreign Affairs, Trade and Defence, the first woman ever to do so. But on Wednesday, David McCullough spoke to Pascal Donoghue and started by asking him just when he knew he was off to Washington.
It's really over the last short number of weeks, everything took final shape.
Okay, but it must have been in the ether for a while. I presume the World Bank doesn't come to these decisions quickly.
No, there was a process that led up to that point, and I applied for the role. There was a process in relation to it, but I really gave my all and was really focused just on my role as finance minister. I had a budget to do, a finance bill to do, and I've always been very clear that that's my job. I'm not interested in other roles while I am doing that. But of course, I had to give consideration to this role. But so the signposting was the committee stage of the finance bill and doing budget 2026.
But you must have been conscious while you were doing that, while you were delivering your budget speech, while you were in this studio answering listeners' questions after the budget, that this was the last time I'm doing this.
I believed it was very likely that would be the case. Very likely. And it was at the back of my mind that would be the case, but I can honestly say it had zero influence on anything I did.
And then they got into the state of the country's finances.
OK, the other criticism is that the prudent Pascal image is a bit of a misnomer given the massive increase in public spending on your watch. I see Barra Rowntree, Assistant Professor of Economics at Trinity, your alma mater, saying your time was characterised by a recklessness reminiscent of Charlie McCreevy during the Celtic Tiger. That's got to hurt.
Lots of different views in relation to what I've done. I leave it to those people. I've been in the room. I've had to deal with, as I said, the many extraordinary challenges of recent years. I leave it to others to form a view in relation to it. What's my record overall? My record overall is I've moved our country from deficit to surplus twice. In the last 3 years, we've run a surplus of between 8 and 9 billion euro.
But if you strip out corporation tax, which is a windfall tax, as you have acknowledged yourself many times, we're running a deficit.
We are running a surplus. That's the bottom line. We're running a very, very big surplus. And if you look at the scale of surplus that we are running, as a share of our overall corporate tax receipts. It's in the mid-range of the different estimates that have been done, that I've done, regarding what could be at risk. By the middle of next year, we will have set aside €24 billion in two different funds to deal with any risks that could be around the corner. And the gains that we have got in terms of corporate tax receipts, they're a result of policy. They're a result of policy that's gone on for decades. And what I have made the case for is as those benefits have come our way, again, due to the hard work and skill of workers here in Ireland, that we set a portion of that aside. And I am convinced that the level of surplus that we now have, the €24 billion we will have set aside next year, is at the highest level that would have been possible while still meeting the capital and spending needs within an economy that itself has grown in the last number of years.
And as we look forward to a by-election for his Dublin Central seat, all that remained was for Pascal Donoghue to thank his constituents.
I have lived in and represented the best part of the best city in the world. And I will always, always be so grateful for the way in which I have been respected and re-elected. And in turn, I have always done my best by the people that I have served in Dublin Central and beyond.
Pascal Donoghue with David McCullough. But for certain satirists, well, a tear in the eye.
And so he goes from Cabinet today. He leaves his TD's job by Friday. And we all hope he's finally happy in his nappy and clapping his handies. But we wish him well. Bye-bye, Betty Pies.
Welcome back. On Sunday Miscellany, a poem for dog lovers everywhere and their dogs.
This is a poem in which a dog is reflecting on its owner. The title is A Dog on His Master. As young as I look, I am growing older faster than he. 7 to 1 is the ratio they tend to say. Whatever the number, I will pass him one day and take the lead the way I do on our walks in the woods. And if this ever manages to cross his mind, it would be the sweetest shadow I have ever cast on snow or grass.
That is quite lovely. That was Billy Collins, a former Poet Laureate of the United States, no less, on Sunday Miscellany. Now, if you loved Wicked, you will be gumming for Wicked for Two, which is in the cinemas now. And on Tuesday, Oliver spoke to the author of The Origin Tale of Oz, the incredibly charming Gregory Maguire.
I must congratulate you because September marked 30 years since the publication of the novel Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, to give it its full title. What was happening in your life, Gregory, as 1995 dawned?
Oh my gosh, Oliver, I had just moved back to the Boston area in the United States after 5 years of living in central London. And I was what the British so fondly call financially embarrassed.
I love that phrase.
I was almost 40. I was 40. And I had written the book and it had been accepted. I'd been paid rather handsomely for it, given what I'd been paid for books before that.
Yeah.
So I came back to the United States in 1995 thinking, this is either the end of my writing career or the beginning of it. Either this will go or it will crush me. And the first week, I thought it was going to crush me. And then the second week, I thought, oh, it's a go. I could tell. I mean, the book was published, let's say, on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and it got a bad review in the New York Times on the Thursday, 2 days out. A stinker, Oliver, a terrible review. I actually, you know, had to turn my eyes to the airport window so nobody could see that it was having its way with me. And then the following Sunday, and I thought, it's done. My career's over.
It's dead.
My agent is going to fire me by the time this plane touches down in Milwaukee. And
Lord.
That's the end of my life. And that was Thursday. On Sunday, the book got a glowing front page, top of the fold review from the LA Times. And on Monday morning, my phone started ringing off the hook from Hollywood.
Unbelievable.
Of people who wanted to option my book. I heard from Claire Danes. I heard from Demi Moore. I heard from Whoopi Goldberg. I heard from any number of actresses who wanted to sew up the rights for this powerful vehicle. And the rest is history. So it was not the end of my career. It was really the beginning.
But before all that, he would spend a little bit of time living in Dublin.
The fall of 74, I lived in Harold's Cross.
Wow.
And went to a school in Ballsbridge called the School of Irish Studies next to the RDS. Beautiful Victorian building in several colours of brick and stone.
You have a rich memory.
Well, you know, it was 6 months, you know, and I was lonely. It was my first time away from my high school bedroom. Mm-hmm. And I loved being in Ireland. I loved being away even more. And from Ireland, I was able to pop over for 10 weeks to travel on the continent and in England for the first time in my life. And all of that was really spectacular and started me off as a lifetime of travel and curiosity about other peoples.
Careful now, we might just claim you. Particularly as you invented a green hero with the name of Elphaba when you made up.
It's entirely a name you invented entirely as a tribute to the original.
As a tribute. As a tribute to the writer Lyman Frank Baum, who published under L.F. Baum. And when I was looking for a name for the witch, because, of course, in order for her to be individualized, she had to have a real name, not just the witch. That's how we demonize people, by calling them the spook, the, you know, the this, the that, the other, you know them all. Yeah. And so I didn't want her just to be a witch. She had to have a name, but she could not have a pretty name. She had to have a name that was, you know, almost a little unpleasant.
Yeah.
And so I took L. Frank Baum's initials and I wrote them down on the edge of my notepad and I played around with them in different iterations. And then I got it by initializing the first one, but articulating, aspirating the second two letters. And there she was, Elphaba. Now she's Elphaba for all time.
Very satisfying.
Which, you know, who else made up a name? Was J.M. Barrie. I don't know if you know this, author of Peter Pan.
Yeah.
J.M. Barrie made up the name Wendy. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So I don't ever think there are going to be little Elphabas on the playground, but but you never know. There are a lot of Elphabas in the dog park, believe me.
J.M. Barrie, you're in very good company there.
And even his own daughter is not above pulling out a wicked number.
Once when my daughter was about 5, she was on the playground at school, and I was called in by the principal, and they said, we really need to ask you to ask your daughter Helen, age 5, to stop singing songs from the Wicked on the playground. And I said, well, I fully understand that Helen cannot carry a tune, so I know why it might be socially objectionable. But what else is this about? And they said, oh, well, we think poor little dear Helen doesn't realize that not every family has its own private family musical.
Oh, my God.
And I said, oh, you don't know Helen very well. She realizes that very well, which is why she's singing them.
I can just see her defying gravity every day. So yeah, that's Dad. It's Dad's
tunelessly defying gravity. Oh my God.
That's amazing.
Gregory Maguire with Oliver, and there was no escaping the Wicked phenomenon this week. But as a film, what's it like? Justin McGregor and Cara O'Doherty gave the review and vital star count to Ciara King on Arena.
You'd want to be living under a rock, by the way, not to have known what's been going on with Wicked for the last 2 years. Where are we and what world is this and how big has this franchise become?
I mean, this franchise is monstrous. Started out as it's one of the longest running shows ever on Broadway. The film, the first film adaptation, is the highest grossing musical adaptation so far that we've ever had. People are obsessed with Wicked. I count myself as one of them. I've seen the stage production 3 times, so a bit of a mega fan here. For people who have been living under that rock, it's basically the origin story, as you say, of Glinda and Elphaba, the two witches. Elphaba is an outsider because she is green. And Glinda is this perfect, gorgeous, pink socialite who just wants everything to be lovely. And despite the fact that they're very different, they become great friends. But there is a problem in Oz, and that is that the wizard is actually not very nice. Animals talk in this land and he has been banishing them. Things have been going very wrong, and Elphaba is very much standing up for those. So by becoming wicked, what she's actually doing is becoming an activist to save people, but that is not how she is cast by propaganda. So the two of them split at the end of the last film, although they know they're both good. The rest of the world can't see that.
And there you have it, Rock Dweller. But now there is a new, albeit very traditional, distraction.
Is it essentially a love triangle between two women vying over a prince, or is it a love story between two friends? How does that play out?
I think it plays much more as a love story between two friends, which is one of the things that's really interesting about it, especially the end, like the last sort of 20, 30 minutes when their friendship is really at the fore. Fiero is basically off screen and kind of somewhere else, and it really becomes very much about them and what they're willing to do, and you know, what they're willing to sacrifice for Oz and for the animals and the community outside of the wizard who they want to leave. And they just do it really well from at the end, sort of when Dorothy and the gang appears. We know from The Wizard of Oz, we know what happens. It's all seen from, she's inside a cupboard and we can just see shadows, and the shadows are miming the fight just like it is in The Wizard of Oz, and it's just really, really well, really well done. And we get to see her emotion of what she's watching.
And finally, bias aside, stars.
I have to take the critic side out a little. It is too long. There's some repetitive scenes there. It is not perfect, but it is beautiful. And when it's good, it's spectacular, and Wicked fans will love it despite the flaws.
Okay, how many stars?
I had to fight with myself, but I'm going with the four.
Four, okay, Justin?
Yeah, no, there's a nice twist too at the end that's not in the book or the stage production, which people will really love. I gave it 4 stars. I mean, what
four
can you
stars,
say?
Well, okay, well, that's a very good review, in fairness, you know.
That's the Begin Sorted. And on Drive Time, they were entering the dating season. All the mistletoe and wine, hot chocolate kisses, ice skating in double mittens. Okay, maybe don't try that one. Lethal. But it is a time that can pile on the pressure to be in your cosies on the couch, 2 by 2. Here's Katie with relationship expert Frances Kelleher.
I suppose it should be said that there are some people who are perfectly happy single on their own. They don't need another half to make them complete. But I do think around Christmas time, even some of those people begin to doubt themselves, because you're surrounded by so much coupling up. All the Christmas movies, or all the rom-coms, all the mistletoe and the tinsel and the Christmas parties. Do you find, maybe I'll ask yourself this, Frances, do you find that people get more anxious about finding somebody around Christmas?
Definitely. It's our busiest time of year. It's the app's busiest time of year. It's what's known as cuffing season. I don't know whether you've heard that modern term.
No, go on, explain.
It sounds slightly rude, but go on.
Well, you know, it's basically, you know, what they're saying is, you know, you cuff someone onto you like handcuffs for the dark, lonely nights from coming into autumn, you know. And
do you call the date the perp walk in that case as well?
might be. But, you know, it is a lonely time of year. It's a sentimental, emotional time of year. You've all the office parties, you've the family gatherings, you know, it is that time of year. And people also, I find, are evaluating the year gone by. And they say, I don't want to be acutely lonely again this year. I'm going to make it my number one priority. And they're getting, you know, to find that person. And they're getting ready for the new year as well. They're saying, what goals do I have for my life in the new year? So it's all of that as well.
Oh, it can be tricky. But don't be that person swiping right for December only to grow oh so chilly in the new year. Special hell for you. Psychotherapist Helen Vaughan was all about being upfront.
How do you know it's the real deal then, that you're not just being used by
the Christmas.
Other person, that exactly a date, that you're not just for Christmas like a puppy, you're for life? Is there a danger you might be used because just somebody else is lonely and they want the date to be there for the festive season?
Well, can you try and be clear on your early dates what you want, what you're looking for? Are you looking for a relationship? Are you looking for something more casual? Do you want something that goes on? Do you want to get married? Do you want to have kids? A lot of people are having those kind of conversations on date one or date two, which I think is different, maybe. Just if you don't want children and the other person does, let's rule them out early and not bother.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
This sounds like the copybook is coming out here.
I would say now a lot of people would run a mile if you started mentioning whether or not you wanted children on date one.
Well, people do, because the earlier you can have those open conversations, the better, I think.
Solid advice, in fairness. So, another drink and a baby. Sure, look, let's go with two. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
I'm in the mood for love, simply because you're